necessarily. No. I think that's too long.
I would love to be
very interested.
You.
Hello. Good morning.
Hey.
How are you?
Hello.
Okay.
This is the strangest, honestly, the round tables.
There should be a feed. There should be one mic and it should somehow feed into all of your phones.
We're just giving away all our phones.
Yeah.
No, it's just there was a lot of like Frank at the first table was like literally dealing the phones and sliding to everybody.
Take our electronics.
How are you?
Good.
Great.
Good. So tell us everything we need.
Dumb. I'm gonna warn you now because if I start to talk and I don't say if I'm going to stop talking, you can tell me to shut up because you may want to ask more and I might not be answering the question ultimately. But what do you want to know? Give me some traction. What do you want to talk about?
Well, what can we expect? Like, how long does it take before the actual?
That's a really good thing. We've always said, I mean, loosely, we're living in the 4 to 5 weeks, and that's the timeline that Robert sort of dictated. It's like Rick was in a coma about 4 or 5 weeks. It seemed an appropriate amount of time for the world to completely fall apart. So we're exploring that time frame. I think as the season plays out, if anybody's keeping, looking at a calendar, we don't really go as far as that. So I think in terms of catching up with, Rick's waking moment and the world is completely gone, that's something that it may extend into season two. It might be something my hope is we will continue to explore it, because one of the things that Robert expressed when he and I first sat down was, I think, you finish a comic, you finish a book, you finish a screenplay, and then down the road you look back and you say, well, I wish I had done X. I mean, I could have gone down that road. There's so much of a story I could have explored. And I think that's what happened. I think there was a number of things that in that initial onset, Robert really wanted to tap into, and I think that's what excited him about doing this. And then, what excited me as well. And it was specific things for him. It's like he really wanted to explore, and this is not so much about the turning point at which we go full on apocalypse, but he was very interested in exploring, exploring the question of violence, and when you're dealing with, in our world, a walker, someone who's infected, who is turned, and they look, for all intents and purposes, human. I mean, I don't know if you guys talked to Greg already, but, the look, it is very specific, and it's not dissimilar from Mimi in season one, but it's, if you didn't have the apocalyptic education that the characters on the original show had, and your sister came back, or a colleague, your first instinct would not be A, to kill them, it would be to run, or B, to help them and try to figure out what was wrong. And when our characters get to a place where they have to do violence, and this will eventually happen to all of them, it takes a toll, and it's emotionally traumatic, and it's psychologically traumatic, especially when you're living in this ignorance and you don't know. You don't know. If I put somebody down, and then 2 days from now, somebody may come to my door and say, "Hey, we found a cure. It's okay now." And it's a really interesting moral and ethical dilemma for these people to be in. And I think it's also something that you don't typically see explored in the genre. I mean, most, and I love them, but most zombie films, you go from, by the end of the first reel, you're there. You know what's going on. You know these people are dead. You know it's okay to, it was actually interesting watching the two trailers yesterday. Because, again, one of the great things about VFX and the great things about Greg does and Ken Foley, you watch the number of decapitations and blood splatter, and it's like, that's the question for me. It's when does our show get to the point where, you're basically going through a wave of walkers and taking them out, and it becomes almost this, it has this exciting, awesome first-person shooter kind of quality to it. I don't think we're going to get there for quite a while, and I think that it feeds into the original question, which is, when our characters get to that place, I think we, without losing, the elements, the energy, the violent elements of the original show or the comic, which I don't want to do. I think it's important that the show needs to live on its own, but it also has to complement and sort of respect what's been established. So I think, you know, we have our moments throughout season one, and we'll have them in season two. But I think the process of our characters completely understanding what this world is and what it means will be a bit slower. You know, so.
Just a question in terms of.
This is when you tell me to shut up.
No, not at all. Just my question would be, you've got an audience that knows more than your characters know about what's happening. And so in a certain way, rather to get your audience behind the characters rather than getting frustrated with their reactions, how have you figured out how to sympathize, get the audience to sympathize, not be frustrated, and yet create a pace where you're going to pay off what some people want to watch the show for, which is, you know, those elements of horror or scares?
It's exactly what you just said. It's a pacing question. And I think the thing about the pilot that's compelling is I think we step into this world, and it's through, you know, it's really through Frank's character, it's through Nick, you know, and it's this, you know, Nick is a guy who has, he's addictive issues, he has problems, and what he saw, he doesn't know it was real, it was not real, and that buys us, I think, in terms of a conceit, it buys us a nice rail for the pilot, which is, we're always going to have at least one person and then slowly more who are getting up to speed. So the audience is watching this and it's like, okay, at least they're starting to piece it together. It's not going to be, and again, I thought it was brilliantly done, but, you know, the Lenny James, Morgan's download to Rick when he made his way to his house and basically said, okay, here's the Apocalypse 101, here's what's going on, here's what you need to know. It's, you know, and it worked beautifully. That story is going to be spread for us over different characters, seeing different pieces of this, trying even simple and silly things like headshots. I mean, actually, if you need to kill one of the churned, how do you do it? What's the best way? You know, and that, again, I kind of get off on that. Just the process of what is the discovery in the real world if we were really confronted by this, where, you know, a colleague you had coffee with yesterday is suddenly trying to rip your throat out. What do you do? You know, and I think our character's instinct is going to be A, to run, B, to try to help them because there's something clearly wrong. That, you know, they're not going to go to a place of they're dead and clearly this is, we've now accepted to the end of George Romero. Nothing against that, but it's like, I don't think that, it's also, I think, the reason why people keep asking, why don't we say zombie? And I don't know if that was a Darabont thing, or if that was a perfect thing,
yeah,
but they've never been comic. So it's a world in which you don't have that shorthand. You know, you can't immediately go to, I know what this is, I know how to behave. And I think that's part of the fun. So it's just a pacing thing, because that's one of the things we wrestled with in the room. Because at a certain point, if you get a character too deep in the show who is, you know, saying it's going to get better, tomorrow's going to be, we have characters who say that and they will suffer for it. But I don't want to get to a place where the audience just wants to slap them and say, wake up, you have to go, zombies, and they're dead, and you're going to deal. I mean,
the audience knows so much more than our characters do. It was kind of frustrating. There were a couple of moments in the pilot where it's like, I was sitting with some people and they were just like, don't go in there! Because, yeah, it's interesting, but that's kind of what makes it really great, too. It is so based in the real world, and that's what allows us to have amazing family dynamics and great, like, character relationships. Like, it is very based in that kind of... not family drama, but, you know, it's all about those characters to start off with, so we can make an amazing foundation, and then that carries us away.
Can you give some insight as far as what your characters are dealing with in the first few episodes?
Oh, gosh.
What have you seen? What do you know?
I haven't seen anything, but the pilot.
Did you see the pilot?
No.
Well, I mean, for Alicia, my character, she's got everything to lose, so she has an ambition, she's got ambition, she's got high hopes, she knows what she wants to do, she's very independent, you know, she's going to Berkeley, she's got a great boyfriend, she's got a very clear path that she wants to go down. They're all needs and desires and wants that she's had to use to fulfill kind of a whole of, you know, this broken family. But because of that, you know, she falls the hardest, falls the fastest, I guess. because then, yeah, she just has everything to lose. So that's, for me, that was the biggest kind of development that I was exploring, and how quickly you come to terms with that sort of stuff, and then dealing with everyone around you and how they're perceiving what's going on too. I mean, I know for Frank and I, our characters are quite opposite in that regard, you know. I mean, not to speak for you, obviously, but Nick, you know, doesn't have anything to lose, really. So that's a really interesting meeting point as well.
Do you think Nick is prepared for the apocalypse or is not?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think so. I do think he's more prepared than anyone else.
We're kicking you out.
Thank you.
I'm going to wrap it up.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you.